Good morning and welcome to Talking Leadership. This is your co-host, Ben Devison, and with my standard host, or much better host, Eric Perez. How are you, Eric?
How are you, mate? Thank you.
And today we are talking with a very good friend of mine, Colin Lee, who in his current capacity is a partner at Carey Group in Townsville. But Cole was also a 17-year veteran of the Australian Army. How are you, Cole?
Yeah, good. Thanks, mate.
And Cole, tell us where you are right now.
So I'm currently in the office, believe it or not, but for the podcast up in Townsville. As you stated, I'm a partner in the Carey Group, which is a financial services and consulting firm. Long history in the region, 68 years. And I was actually a client of the firm for 11 years while I was in the army before I actually joined. And I've been in the firm for 7 years now, partner in the last three. And yeah, enjoying the life of Tropical North Queensland during what has been a unique year, to say the least.
You're not wrong. You are not wrong. So, interesting career pathway, Cole, particularly going from a very successful military career and straight into the financial services sector. So, just interested to know what was your transition? Was that a planned transition towards late in your career, or as a client of Carey Group, did you just see the kind of work they were doing and just thought, oh, I reckon I can do that?
Yeah, look, it's probably a long pathway. I mean, even well, for a bit of context, I was born and raised on a dryland cereal cropping property in the Riverina. Joined the army after that, but when I was looking to join the army, the other things I was looking at was accounting and business through university. But I went on to the army and went through the Defence Force Academy, then Duntroon, and then I had my 17 years after that in. Out in the real army. And about halfway through that career, I was posted to Townsville to headquarters 3 Brigade. And I got a word of mouth referral to see an accountant because you had to do your tax returns. And I was, getting sick of having to change every 2 years. We went around, and that's where I met Joe Carey, who's one of the partners of the firm. And yeah, I really appreciated or got to enjoy the benefit of the value of advice that I got through the firm while I was in the military. Really around that time, after I'd been a client for a couple of years, I sort of started thinking, well, what happens when I get to around the 20-year mark? Am I going to keep going on or will I look to get out? I kept talking to Joe every year when we did our tax and did our financial planning, and I was getting more and more interested in it. And then for me, career-wise, I had a couple of decision points. I didn't get selected in the A-team to go to staff college, and instead ended up in Afghanistan on operations. And from that came back, went into headquarters strategic military commitments, which is really the go-to cell for the Chief of the Defence Force. Spent 8 months there as a staff officer to a two-star. And then from there, ended up in Special Operations Command at the headquarters doing logistics or strategic planning logistics-wise for their operational deployments overseas. And finished up again in over in Afghanistan as the S4 for the Special Operations Task Group. While I was over there, I got a telephone call just saying, look, an opportunity's come up. Would you like to go on exchange to the US for 2 years into the Defence Logistics Agency distribution? I had no idea what that was, but I said yes, and went over there. And while I was over there, it was sort of, it got to the point where it was time to start thinking about, well, what do we do when we get back to Australia. And I actually contacted Joe from in the States and said, look, I'm interested in making a career change. What are your thoughts? And he gave me some guidance around, that potentially there might be a role for me when I got back to Australia, but that obviously required doing some additional postgraduate study. So I started studying my postgraduate qualifications in financial planning while I was in the States. Came back to Australia, went on long service leave, finished off that postgraduate training. And part of that, Ben, was actually using the Career Transition Assistance Scheme to fund the last three subjects of that training, which was quite good. And then I came in and literally at the ground level into a sort of client support officer, paraplanning role, did that, pretty much sucked on a fire hose for 6 months, and then was licensed as an advisor in February 2014. And have continued on from there. So it was actually a planned thing that I had worked towards, both in terms of having a timeline to work towards it. It wasn't a spur of the moment decision. Had engaged the leadership or listened to Joe's version about what was possible. Years ago we spoke about whether should I look at accounting or should I look at financial planning, and The financial planning was more of a fit for me because, strategic planning in defence is solving complex problems for a big complex organisation. What I do now is solving complex problems for, both individuals as well as, businesses and those sorts of things.
Being a young lad from the Riverina, I actually wasn't far down the road. I was down in the northern areas of Victoria around Albury-Wodonga myself. So let's talk about your leadership pathway as a kid growing up in that area. And obviously you were drawn to the Defence Force Academy in a leadership role. So can you tell us about the beginning of your leadership pathway?
If I went back and reflected on leadership side of it, it wasn't, I'm a leader, I want to join the army or whatever. I think my earliest experiences with leadership came, like a lot of people, through sporting endeavours. Sport is a big part of rural and regional communities. For me, it was through Australian rules football. And, you spend a lot of time getting mentored by coaches and senior players, and then you come through the ranks. And, in country football and country cricket, often a lot of the time there's not enough people to fill all the teams in different grades. So, cricket for an example, I'd spend the morning playing under 16s cricket, and then in the afternoon you'd find yourself playing in B grade or A grade cricket alongside, fully grown men. And that in itself brings its own, lessons and observations. And football was the same. You would often find that the players in the thirds would get, pulled off halfway through their game to rest up to play half a game, in the reserves. And it was all about, gradually easing you into that harder environment. And you see a lot of people through that. Also, I think in year 11, I got involved in car racing in the sporting car club back home. And, I remember going along to the AGM and coming home as the treasurer. So, that's an interesting dynamic as well. But, that wasn't done by the club deliberately. It was, a case of, would you like to do it? Yes, I would. And then, you receive the assistance and mentoring of, like the president of the club and the secretary of the club. And the other probably key point from a leadership perspective is, which, you might know, you grow up in a rural community, especially in farms. You're actually working on the farm during peak periods, during school holidays, and, you're working alongside adults. So, again, there's a bit of an element of mentoring and leadership there that you pick up on, and seeing how, from a, even from a strategic perspective, how different people do things differently. We were dryland cereal croppers, and what my parents did was that they went very early down the path of minimum tillage agriculture, and from that, a lot of lessons came out of that, and they were sort of ahead of the bow wave in terms of how that movement has come through. And, here we are, a good probably 30 years since, I left home. And, the thing that's becoming all of the popular thing at the moment is regenerative agriculture and minimum tillage. And so, it's a strategic thinking mindset that looks at things a little bit differently.
I'm going to come back to that theory in a little bit, Eric. I think the something Cole brought up that I've actually had a bit of study in the past is around the influence of a regional background on the future of people. But anyway, let's come back to that a little bit later.
Yeah, and there's something I want to come back to around this, the issue of sport, a training ground for, I guess, a leadership background. It's come up in most of these podcasts. And for those listening, by the end of November, I've hit 100. And I can, if I go back and listen to all of them again, I think that the majority have mentioned sport in one to one degree or another. So, yeah, happy to play on those themes, Ben. So, Cole, just following question for you, mate. What do you believe are the leadership skills that you've adapted from the military context to the civilian context?
Look, I think, I have thought about this a little bit, and I think it comes back to your values and how you position and how flexible and adaptable you are. From a, leadership skill wise, and even more broadly, your planning skills and that sort of stuff. Defence invests an enormous amount of time and effort in training people, and you don't really appreciate it until you get out. When you're going through the military training cycle, it's, almost ad nauseum about, how much you do. And I think the benefit of that is you see it when you get out, and you see how little some organisations will put into training because it's driven by a dollar cost and you know, doing what they need to do. You know, what the military is trying to do is train people to be effective leaders. What civilian industry, I think, is after is people who are efficient and, you know, driven by a dollar cost or profit margin. But in defence, it's about making sure that you're effective because the outcomes or the end games that you're playing to are very defined with, you know, serious consequences, which is very different to civilian industry. You know, I think back and look at, you know, the things that are important is integrity for leaders. You know, that's always been my biggest thing, regardless of anything else. You've got to do the right thing and you've got to be able to look yourself in the mirror every day and be comfortable with the decisions that you've made because they won't always be popular. I think listening is a big leadership skill, you know, listening and actually listening to what people are saying without formulating an opinion so that you can then sit back, observe what they've said, analyze it, then make a decision and go and execute it. And one of the other ones, you know, from a leadership perspective comes back to the three core Army values from my time there. And, you know, they're on display. It's been a while since I've been on Defence Base, so I don't know if they still are, but certainly in Ben and my time, you'd drive onto any Army base, and as you drove in, there'd be three big signs, one after the other, which was courage, initiative and teamwork. And if all else, you know, the Army had more values than that, and I can't tell you what they were, but everyone knows what those three core values are. And if any situation you found yourself in, if you applied integrity and kept in mind courage and initiative and teamwork, you could probably deal with any situation that was thrown your way. And the important one there, I think, also is on the courage side of it, from a leadership perspective, is there's physical courage, which is, you know, the doing the hard things in defence that you have to do. But the harder one is probably, you know, moral courage, and that's being prepared to make the right decision, the hard decision, and call it out. And that's not easy to do. And whether that's in a military context or a civilian context, I think that's one that is often overlooked on the civilian side. I mean, if you go and look at, you know, one of my favourite things, you know, I like to do in the rare bits of spare time I have is I like to read. But what I like to read is I like to read actual things or, you know, biographies or autobiographies. And also I like reading things, whether it's on the military side or the business side, about things that have gone pear-shaped. And, you know, you can read it and look at it and go through and find out, you know, well, what went wrong and why did it go wrong? And often a lot of those things come back to that moral courage aspect. You can look at it and say, look, that's going to end bad. And we haven't even, I'm not even halfway through the book yet.
I appreciate that response. And it, part of what you said segues into my next question about the content, the leadership context that you'll have in the military versus the leadership context in the civilian world. So do you think, having had a foot in both camps, that they are significantly different to each other, or they're much the same, but there are some key differences? Or what's been your experience, Cole?
Yeah, look, I think they're similar but different. And it comes back to what I was saying earlier on about, you know, leadership in the military setting versus your civilian or private sector is that, you know, the decisions we make and the things that we're doing in defence have serious consequences if they've gotten wrong. And that involves, you know, people die. At the end of the day, that's as simple as it gets. If you get it wrong, you're dealing with a consequence, which is a loss of civilian life or the life of your soldiers, and or they end up very badly injured. So that's a real defined end game that sharpens your focus that doesn't really exist in the civilian context. In the civilian context, it's more around, you know, leadership's driven around making sure that you're profitable, and that will mean that your enterprise or your organisation survives and continues to grow and thrive. And, you know, that's the sort of different framework at the start. The one thing I find different for defence, if I reflect on it, and I saw this recently as a blog I follow, Bram Connolly, Warrior U. Bram is a ex-commando that came through the ranks, and he does a lot of stuff on leadership. But he was making some reflection recently about what is different from a leadership perspective is that sense of team, you know, the shared purpose, everyone being on board with the same strategic end goal, like you know where you're going. You know where you're going in your small little unit, but you also know two levels above where things are going, and you're keeping that in mind in your decision framework. I think ethics plays a very important role, and certainly which the profession of arms is probably the thing that keeps people to account, you know, integrity and ethics. And then the other one that's really relevant for the military, and I keep trying to pull it across into the civilian sector, even through the carer group here, is this concept that we use in the military of commander's intent, purpose, method, end state. Just breaks everything down to its simplest forms. You know, you could have a 40-page set of orders that covers a very complex strategic plan, but if everyone knows that simple paragraph, which is the commander's intent, mission is the other one I left out, sorry, the mission, what it is that you're trying to do. You understand the purpose of why you're doing it. You understand the method, which is how you're going to do it, and you understand the end state. If you empower people with that knowledge as a leader, what that does is it means if something fundamental changes, they can actually adapt what they're doing to still meet that end state without coming back and asking for permission, so to speak.
I was just going to say, that last point, Cole, something that I have regularly used in my post-military life as well. And more recently, I've been using the phrase, why? So talking to a business and understanding why they exist. And it's not to make money. It's not to deliver a service, but what's the outcome they're seeking for the reason they exist. And I totally agree. When you actually get that right and you can permeate that viewpoint through your business and empower everyone to know that everything they do is about delivering that why statement, which is essentially the commander's intent, it really does clarify what people are there for. What, in your view, are the critical capabilities that leaders need?
I come back again to what I said before. I think integrity is important as a, you know, it's not a skill or a capability, but it keeps you true to your purpose and will really focus you on what you're doing. Technical skills are important, but one of the things I've found, especially since coming into, I mean, you see it in defence and you see it in the civilian sector, but differently. I think what defence is really good in terms of training its leaders and developing them is that, you know, it doesn't matter whether you're a junior NCO or an officer, but defence and the army is really good at it. It'll put you in a position that you know nothing about, and you'll spend 18 months for 2 years learning it really quickly, getting up to speed. And the second that you're proficient at it, they pull you out of that environment. If you're an officer, you know, typically they'll post you to the other side of the country, different unit, different brigade, different skill set, new role, and in another position you've never done before. You may have seen people doing it above you, but now it's on you to be responsible for that. So they're just that constant evolution of your skill set, and I think that's important in developing people. So, you know, trying to bring that sort of mindset across, you know, I found actually making the transition, you know, complete career transition, going from, you know, strategic planning and logistics in defence, coming into financial planning, was that, you know, I could quite comfortably stand up and brief, you know, 100 soldiers and know exactly what was going on and be comfortable with stuff. And then going into your first appointment where it's one-on-one in a room with a client and being terrified because you all of a sudden you realise, well, I don't know all the answers. And that in itself is an important skill as well, as being able to realise when you don't know the answer and go away and look into it. I remember my first CO, which was Colonel Craig Orme at the Tank Regiment. He used to have this thing where he said, you know, don't ever say should or believe, you know, it should be there or I believe it's going to be there. He said, you either know or you don't know. And he said, there's nothing wrong with saying, I don't know, and then go away, do the research, find out the answer, come back and tell people, and then you can go on. Otherwise, you're just making an uneducated guess, so to speak. And the other thing I think that's important for leaders is, you know, I think it's important to surround yourself with a good team. You know, that's something that you take out of the military. And I think even in the last 7 years of being here in the firm, you know, I've learned some valuable lessons where, you know, you may get something wrong. You're never going to make the right decision about a team member. But it's always important to try and surround yourself with the right type of people, and, you know, the time spent on selecting the right type of people to support you and for you to support them is fundamental in making sure that you know, you're setting yourself up for success.
The interesting point you made there, I thought, You're right. Yeah, you can stand up in front of 100 soldiers, you can deliver orders, you can do whatever. But that first day when you're in front of a brand new client in a suit and tie, it's a totally different example of, let's just say, fear, in my view. And yeah, it's almost like some of those confidence hats that you put on, maybe you can call it an alter ego sometimes you put on in the military. It just escapes you. So, but thinking about that list there, Cole, so do you think the list would differ, those capabilities differed in the military context?
I think, you know, like Eric was saying earlier, or his observation, you know, a lot of it's similar but different. I think one of the key differences, though, and it's important for, you know, military people, military leaders to realise that when they go out of the military into the private sector, it is a very different experience. And I think that's where you really need to reflect on the ability to listen and understand what's going on in this new environment, but also prepare yourself that things don't operate exactly the same way. You know, I know that we're very used in the military context that, you know, we have all this decision making and people are very open about giving frank and fearless feedback. And then, you know, in fact, one of my squadron commanders before, Roger Simons at the Light Horse Regiment, said to me, or he said to all of us at the start of the year, he said, you can say whatever you want up until decision point. You know, don't be scared in giving frank and fearless feedback. But once we make a decision, that's it. We get on and we execute it, and we don't, you know, we leave all the rest of it behind. And so the military is very good at doing that. And then you come into the civilian sector, and I think if you have that expectation that the same thing is going to happen, and that same openness in terms of frank and fearless feedback, as well as also the ability to execute quickly, you could be setting yourself up for disappointment. And I think the other thing that's important for, you know, military people to remember is that one thing that you don't have in defence when you come out of it is you've got no profit and loss experience. And, you know, you may have managed a project or a budget that's got, you know, $100 million budget, but you're never running to a profit and loss outcome. And that's fundamentally important for big organisations. I remember years ago, probably when I was about, you know, I'd done about 12 or it might have been when I was finishing up subunit command. I actually applied for, I thought, you know, I'll go and see what else is out there. And I applied for a role with a large, oh, it's an international corporation. I won't say who it was, but predominantly around workshops and diesel engines. And I was, you know, I found the process of going through that quite enlightening. It actually taught me that some of the things we complained about in defence aren't as bad as what we think. I think we're very critical of what we do in defence. But one thing that came out of that was, they threw me in as a wild card. I got shortlisted. I was flown down to Brisbane for an interview. And then they said, we'll have a decision by tomorrow. It took them 3 weeks to make a decision because they kept coming back to me and saying, look, we put you in as a wild card and we didn't expect you to perform as highly in the interviews as what we thought. And when it came down to it in the end, what they really struggled with was, look, you don't have any, we've got no qualms, you'd be able to manage a workshop, you'd be able to manage a sales team, you'd be able to manage this, but you've got no evidential history of, you know, even though you've facilitated the change out of a tank platform in a tank regiment, we've got no profit and loss history there for you. And that for them was a big thing. So the important thing for me was, well, I've got to think about, well, how do I sharpen my skills in that regard so that when I come into the civilian sector eventually, like when I do transition out, you know, how do I do that? And I think that's important just in terms of helping people develop their skills, because when you come across from defence, you might be on your A-game there, but you're not going to be on your A-game to start with in a new organisation, because you've got new skills to learn. And a lot of those are soft skills about dealing with people and situations that are different to what you've had to deal with in the past.
That's actually a really good point about the profit and loss, Cole. Could not agree more. The ability to add value to a bottom line is a difficult skill to try and transition with. And yeah, we were always empowered to deliver the best we could with the assets and resources we had. But you're right, it never had a budget versus actual outcome at the end.
Yeah, and it's, look, you know, as I mean, you know yourself, having started your own business, and as I know from being an equity partner in a business here, as well as working with all our clients who are running businesses, you know, profit and loss is what makes the wheels go around. It's what makes a company endure, what makes it survive hard times. You know, one thing that we've seen is, and I was talking to Eric about this just before we started, was, you know, Townsville went through a really hard patch a while back when Yubulu closed in Townsville. It was not long after I got back here. It was about 2 years after I started as an advisor. You know, I think there's something like about 6,000 people left town as a result of, you know, jobs and taking families with them and those sorts of things, which had a flow-on effect to, you know, all these businesses that supported the mining sector. And, you know, what that, you know, eventuated in is a lot of, you know, people stopped putting their hands in their pockets and started trying to save money everywhere. And we spent a lot of time working with clients to improve their businesses and get them through the hard times and that sort of stuff. And then, you know, we had the floods in towns at the end of 2019, which was sad because economically the North Queensland region was really starting to turn and hit its straps again. And so we had that period through the floods and the rebuilding, and literally on the anniversary of the floods, 12 months later, we came into the COVID environment, which impacted a lot of people. But, you know, what we have seen is that the value of what we did working with clients on their businesses through those hard times and positioning them for success is they've been able to endure the COVID environment, I think, a lot better, and actually positioned their businesses to perform well through this tough period. Obviously, it's a little bit different up here in the north to say down in Victoria, but that, you know, that border down south is still closed, and that has a flow-on effect to tourism coming into the region, and has an effect for people trying to come up here with jobs and those sorts of things. But yeah, it's been really good to see, you know, if you can make your business, and this is one of our core principles, if you can make your business hum and thrive during the hardest of times, then when it's good, you know, you're going to do really, really well, and you'll get a reward for all that effort that you put in, and, you know, the leadership that you've shown in positioning your business. And even just one thing I'll touch on is it's been really interesting to see how, from a leadership perspective, some business owners have fundamentally pivoted and shaped and shifted their businesses to deal with what COVID threw up. You know, I know when the borders were shut and we had the initial lockdown, et cetera, and one of the, you know, it's my favourite restaurant in town, A Touch of Salt, you know, it's a Chef Hat winning award restaurant. It made an announcement, I think, on the Friday that we're going to pivot and we're going to deliver takeaway options for our clientele because the restaurant's shut. And by, I think that was on the Friday, I think by the Monday morning, they had the website built, they had, you know, the Gen 1 version of what they're going to do up and running, and it evolved a few times. And look, they have continued to perform and go well. They've been supported by their clientele. You know, even in our family, we made a decision that we want to support, you know, 1 week, every Saturday for us, we decided we'd support a different local food business, restaurant or a takeaway, because that's their livelihood at the end of the day. And it was really interesting to see how some people adapted to that. And even on reflection, I went to a restaurant recently during the Queensland election campaign. And what they had was a, you know, a QR code that you scanned on your phone. You filled out your details, you submitted it, and you picked up a menu at the table you're sitting at. You scanned another code there, you ordered your meal and your drinks. And the first time you saw anyone, you'd already paid for it. It was just basically things being put on your table. And just think about, you know, the efficiencies that offers. And, you know, that's leadership, because not every business around town is doing that, or not every business in the food industry is doing that. You can go to some places and they're still giving you a pen and pencil to fill out your name, address and your phone number.
Yeah, now, good example, Cole. Now, I mentioned before I was going to go rogue. So I'm interested to sort of get your thoughts on a bit of a study I did probably about 15 years ago when I was working for a big accounting firm. Now, we looked at about 500 long-term employees over many, many years to try and understand a bit of a demographical study about where the best people came from. And the understanding being, were there any correlations between the university performance, where they went to school, where they grew up, etc., etc. Now, there were some fairly, let's just say, tenuous links between what were indicators early in life and what were performance indicators later in life. But one thing that did pop out to me was one of the indicators for longevity, so retention, and one of the indicators for high performance came from those who had gone to high school in a regional area. Now, you, like me, Cole, were one of those kids who went to high school in a regional area. What do you think of that point? Do you think that, let's just say, kids that grow up in a regional setting just have a different mindset to life, be it a work ethic? Things are a bit harder, therefore your resilience is a little bit more, let's just say, a little bit more hardened. Yeah, what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, look, I think living in regions, and it, you know, I can only talk about my experience. I don't know if it's different now for people, but you know, you live in a region or a rural community, and community is very important. And you get exposed to a lot of things that you possibly don't get in bigger urban environments or major cities. You know, for example, you talk about resilience, and you know, like from a young age, you know, we had motorbikes as kids growing up, and it was nothing to, you know, as a 12-year-old to jump on your motorbike, your XR80, and tell mum and dad you're going off to see your mate. Your mate just happens to live 30 kilometres away on the other side of, you know, the town, and you're going through all these back roads and everything else. Spend the entire day there doing stuff, ride home in time for dinner, and you wouldn't bat an eyelid at it, you know, whereas, you know, that just doesn't, I don't think that happens today in more build-up communities. I think it still does happen to agree out in the farming communities. I think growing up on a farm gave me a very unique, or probably contributes to the point you're getting to, you get exposed to different things. So you start working from a young age, and you know, you understand that you know, what goes on to make a farming enterprise successful, and you see the ones that aren't successful. You know, you're working alongside adults, you're working in family businesses. Like we even see, you know, when you're recruiting, trying to recruit new team members, if you find someone who's come from out of working in a family business, or they've had some exposure to it, you know, they've seen what the commitment that their parents have put into it and what goes on with it. And that becomes evident in their rate of effort, their output, and how they fit in and how they think. Whereas someone who's lived in a more sheltered environment is very different. One thing I found really interesting as well is, and this might go slightly off track because I don't know whether the same thing applies to rural communities now, but because everyone's got a device in their hand, you know, Generation Y, Millennials, Generation Z, they talk on their devices, and you know, you actually get people who come in, they've been through university, they've graduated, put into a position, they are terrified to pick up a phone and talk to someone. And I just find that astonishing, because that's, you know, different to the environment that we've had. But then from a leadership perspective, you know, the onus then comes on us to help firstly identify that and start gently pushing them down the path of, you know, you've got to do this. For all the power of Zoom and technology and everything else, nothing beats face to face. And you know, I did a post on LinkedIn recently where I said, you know, one of the best parts of my job is actually where I get back out into that rural and regional community, and you go out and visit people in their businesses, and you see your clients in their businesses, and you understand firsthand what's holding them up. And I think that's very powerful in terms of, you know, building a strong client base and building strong teams, understanding those people. And you know, it's a pretty interesting study, I think, that what you've done. And I would tend to agree that I think people in those rural and regional communities get exposed to a lot more. You know, again, from a resilience perspective, you know, when I'm growing up working on the farm, you're also involved in things like, you know, the volunteer bushfire brigade. So when I see things happen on the news, like the big fires and stuff like that, you have a deep empathetic understanding for it, because as a 15-year-old, you're out there on the back of a fire truck fighting fires because there's no one else there to do it. You're out in the bush. So that, you learn a lot of skill sets. I think people in the bush and the rural communities learn to be more adaptable, and that sense of community and shared purpose, I think, is important. I think if you can find those types of people and bring them into your organisation, you stand a better chance to build strong, cohesive teams. The thing that, you know, one thing that I find as a challenge, you know, when we're looking at businesses is, when you're recruiting people, you know, gone are the days where someone would come and, you know, join the carer group and stay for, you know, 30 years and then retire. These days you're talking about, you can hold someone for 2 or 3 years, then for, you know, the younger generation, that's a long-term commitment for them. And I think what you need to do is look for ways around how you can support them and lead them. And one thing we've seen here, we've seen people over the years where they've come in the firm, they've worked, they've gotten you know, skills and experience, and then they've left to go off and do other things. But then, you know, a few years down the track, they've come back to the firm. You know, and if you look in our partner group of 8, two of the accounting partners started in the firm, left to go get corporate experience and start their own firms, and have come back into the fold. I'm a little bit different. You know, I may have been a client, but I saw the value of what this firm does. And, you know, I've traveled around, had a lot of broad experiences, dealt with other firms, and you know, I've come back into here and come back into a leadership role. So one thing that's consistent, again, with our business is a lot of our team, not only in the partners, but in the team itself, they all come. There's a lot of people who come from those rural and regional communities. You know, the firm started in Ingham, which is a big cane farming region. But we've got a lot of clients who are graziers out west. We've got horticultural producers up on the tablelands. We've got professionals that work in the firm are clients of the firm, but their work is transient. So they might go to Melbourne or Sydney or whatever, but they remain clients of the firm. But what's important is that broad skill base and that background that the team has means that the team members right down to, our junior advisors and our junior accounts and our admin team, they resonate really well with clients and they interact really well with clients. And I think that's a fundamental point of difference that we have compared to a lot of competitors who may be bigger than us.
Cole, sorry, Ben, just there's so much to unpack with what you just said that I might get to one element of what you said about the youth coming through and the use of technology. You're not the first person I've heard that observation around younger generations that are coming through that are living and socializing and planning their worlds around their devices. That is going to become more and more of a problem for businesses going forward, particularly those businesses that rely on people to have those people skills that you and me and probably maybe others take for granted, that that's a skill set that you need to be able to pick up a phone, be able to see someone in an office face-to-face, go out and meet with clients. In some of those sectors, the cost of retraining is going to come not just because of things like COVID, but because the culture around the technology that we're using to socialize ourselves, let alone our kids, is changing as well. The days, I guess, in urban centers like where I live, have been able to get on your bike and travel 30Ks to go see your mate. That is just not a reality of this part of the world. And I can understand when you were saying that in rural locations it's a bit different because of the size of where you are and you need to travel to get around and stuff. But I would suggest that those qualities that you're talking about, the ability to pivot, the ability to deal with lots of different things, is not just a rural regional trait. I think you'll find that in urban centres as well. I guess you have to look for it maybe a little bit harder. And one other point, and you said this more towards the start of the podcast, that was interesting when you were going through that recruitment process, and they said, did they say you're a wild card? They actually use that terminology with you?
It wasn't said during the interview. It was said by one of the selection committee, who was the state manager for Queensland, and that was in the Qantas Club. I happened to bump into him the next day, and then I rang him about 5 days later. Hey, I'm just wondering what's going on, and that's sort of he sort of said on both occasions, yeah, they haven't. He said, I'm firmly in your camp. He said, there's four of us. He said, two are firmly in your camp and the other two are struggling because you're a wild card and you've got no profit and loss experience. And that's ultimately where it came.
Yeah, it's a shame that the recruitment process is still in some parts of our economy, and I won't pinpoint those specifically, but I'm just as aware as what in that story that you've just shared, that people still recruit with what, and they look at what you don't have versus the potential you could bring to the role, which is really, it's my podcast, so I say, it really shits me to tears that this happens on more regular basis than people want to admit. Like, for example, now that we've had these conversations and I've only done the five podcast, and Ben's been a big part of getting me to meet some of you guys and to talk about what you know, that shit, if I ran my own business, I'm going to be actively, the day that I do this, I'll be actively looking for people with a defense background, not because I did the podcast, but when you mentioned the types of skills that are needed in the military context, these things are actually needed more in the private sector than you might be aware of. So when you're talking about strategic thinking, planning ahead, foresight, those capabilities in leaders, for me, and this comes back to some of the studies I'm doing, these are some core capabilities you need in human beings to be effective leaders. Now, if you're choosing a path of leadership, you can be as persuasive as you want, you can be as good a communicator as you want, but if you can't envisage possible different futures and you don't have a strategy or roadmap to get there, you're not going to be as effective a leader as you might need. And if from the military context that is getting inculcated at all levels of the military, wherever you're serving, that makes for a very good employee base, because you've got people that can deal with changes as they come up. Yes, the civilian context is different, but it gives you a more, potentially, I think, a different kind of employee, because it's, I think it's too easy for those of us that haven't been in a service type role, so police, ambulance, army, navy, whatever the services are, those services where you require people to be operating at that next level of thinking and physical condition, that in a civilian world, it's easy for us to hide and say, well, we don't have a life and death thing to worry about here. It's only work. Well, it might only be work for you, but the people that own the business want it to thrive. They have families relying on them to provide a place to work. So I don't think, and I'm not making the direct comparison, don't get me wrong here, but for those in that entrepreneurial set, Ben, yourself and others that provide a place for people to go and work, the decisions you make and the ability to be transparent is important, because in some ways you have lots of other people relying on you to keep a business alive, for them to have a place to work. And that should mean something to people. Even if you're only going to work to make a paycheck, you've got to have people that are thinking more broadly than just the job to have that job there. Does that resonate with you, Cole?
I think so. And like, just when you were talking about, you know, the important, you know, that what you see as potential benefit in recruiting ex-military people, you know, whether it's ex-military here or anyone off the street, one thing that I've learned, I've probably learned the hard way, but if you recruit on attitude, you can train, you can teach everything else. If you find someone who's got all the technical skill sets and everything else, but their attitude is wrong, then you're going to spend a lot of time unpicking that, and you're going to end up at the wrong point of where you wanted to be. So I think that's important as well, and that's what I think military people give you in spades, is that they will give you the right attitude, the ability to, you know, change quickly. What's old Bear Grylls say? Adapt, improvise, and overcome. You can teach them what you need to teach them. You can teach them the soft skills. You can teach them new skills in a new industry. If they've got that right attitude, it'll deliver hand over fist a return on investment.
And don't get me wrong. In some industries, for example, let's say the Kerry Group only worked in a sales environment. I know that you don't, but let's say that's the only area you worked in. You needed high level people with experiences in sales, and it's a high pressure environment. Okay, it's a lot riskier to get someone that has absolutely no sales experience and hope you put them into that role and they succeed. Okay, I could understand that. But in other roles where it's not potentially a high pressure environment, or the business lives or dies by your ability to sell, yeah, the right attitude, you can train anyone to do almost anything if they're prepared to give it a go, which again comes back to my point. When we recruit for people, we're looking for what skills do they have versus what is their potential to add value to the business, even if they didn't have those skills. Because based on your example, I would have given you a shot in that job. It didn't matter that you didn't have certain skills. It's always a calculated risk. But if they've seen you, they've put you through multiple recruitment steps and they've talked to you, and they do their due diligence by checking on your work history and check with your referee, surely to God they could have given you a chance. And I think it's naive to think when you recruit for people you're going to get the perfect person applying every time. I don't think that exists. I really don't think that exists.
Well, going through that process was a very good learning experience. You know, bear in mind at that stage I'd been in the army for 15 years. This is the very first time I've actually gone and said, yeah. And I just did it on a whim. I put in an application and got a call the next day, and I'd done a shortlist telephone interview for half an hour, and then got shortlisted and flown to Brisbane and did this interview. So that was one experience that I had. What was interesting was that I got to look outside of the environment I was in and see what was on the other side of the fence. And that was important in that regard, just to have a broader understanding. And as luck would have it, you know, yes, I didn't get the job, but it was I learnt lessons out of that, of what I needed to look at when the time eventually got to come out.
All right, Cole. So we have the standard question every time we have one of these podcasts. Your view, mate. Is it nature versus nurture? Are leaders born or are they made?
Look, I would say I think the answer is both. You'll get natural born leaders, that's for sure. And then you'll get people who have the right attitude and who will develop and evolve over time. That's genuinely what I think. What I think is interesting on the juxtaposition of that question is how do you deal with people, or is it important to have people who aren't leaders? And the reason I ask that question is I see it in civilian industry and I saw it in defence as well, especially, you know, in my corps, which was Ramey. I used to think that defence, you know, was all focused on upskilling people and putting them in the next leadership role and moving them on. And it wasn't really good at dealing with people who said, but I like working on tanks and trucks and, you know, artillery pieces. That's what I want to do. And there was this view that, well, they weren't a good leader because they weren't looking to progress and move on. But I think in any organisation, it's important to have those technical, highly skilled people who are the doers and the worker bees. And it's the same in civilian industry. You know, not everyone who works in, you know, the accounting profession, for example, wants to go on and be, a senior partner or a manager or, you know, run their own accounting business. A lot of people are really happy being that technical expert and being able to work closely with their little bunch of clients and help their clients deliver an outcome. And if they're not necessarily interested on progressing past that, you know, that's not a bad thing. It's important to have people at different levels of the organisation. And conversely, when you find some of those people, if at a particular point in their career they decide that, oh, actually, you know, I think I do want to make the next step, but I'm a bit unsure about how to go around it. Well, that's the importance of mentoring and leadership and where you can actually help those people who don't necessarily have that natural born leadership style to develop the skills they need and make that transition that they need to do. But yeah, look, there's definitely natural born leaders, and there are people who develop over time and become quite effective leaders as a result.
A lot of our guests have spoken in a similar vein, Cole, that it's more of a 50-50, maybe 60-40, whatever, wherever you sit. But when I was asked the very same question, I think I used the word made, I think, Eric, but I have transitioned my thoughts over time hearing people like yourself.
Mate, I change my view every time I have a bloody podcast. So, because I think if I'm putting the reality glasses on with this question, it's always an interesting question because it's not so much the answer, but the process that that the guests have given to how they come up with that answer. And I think it, for me personally, I think it would be naive to think that you won't get an occasional leader or someone that's born that just has all of those right qualities just in their DNA to be a good leader or a good potential leader versus, and the military is an example of this, you can take a rough clump of clay and turn them into something better than they were when you started. And so what I think I've missed in the process of asking that question is, it's how much time will you or your business or your industry invest in developing the people to be that next generation of effective leaders? And that's the bigger question. I believe, at least in my travels, that in the ag sector in general, there's a lot of work done to try and develop leaders. My question's always been, how effective is that work to develop leaders? From doing the podcast with you guys, it seems to me defense, like, it's leadership training ad nauseum. It's all the time. You're constantly being assessed. It's part of the environment. And in the civilian world, I think it's taken a little bit for granted. At least that's my experience. Could it be done better? Probably. The question I'm starting to form in my own mind as someone with a research bent is, if I ask both of you, and you don't have to answer this, but if I ask the question, do you believe in your sectors you have fit for future leaders? Is your immediate response a yes? If it's not, then what's happening with how we develop our leaders? And that, I think that's more than just a research question. That's a practical question. That's an entrepreneurial type question, because that fully agree, you need technical people. You need people to do the doing of the work that don't want leadership positions, but then you need to have some people steering the ship of state. And my question is always going to be, how do we develop those people? And over and above the, you know, in the studies I've done, there's at least 70 odd theories of leadership that are floating around out there. For me, my thinking on this is starting to move more towards leader capabilities. What are those three or four or five capabilities that, irrespective of industry, you need to have to be an effective leader? And that's a question I think that doesn't get a lot of airplay in a more broad way, because again, if I ask the question, what is our baseline in any industry to see how effective our leaders are, I don't think we do work like that, because it to me, it asks some uncomfortable questions about the quality of the leadership that we've got. And those that are in leadership positions, me included, if someone's going to come at you and say, where are you not so effective? Some people take that very personally. Some people take it on as very constructive, and then everything in the middle. So interested to get your thoughts on that, guys. Like, from your perspective, you don't have to name a boss or an individual, but do you believe in your sectors you have fit for future leaders or not?
I'll let you go first, Ben.
Well, to use your benchmark there, Eric, of having an immediate response, my immediate response is I can't say yes. And I'm speaking from the legal community. And I think as we've all spoken, be it directly or implied, there are people who are promoted through their technical prowess. And whilst they may be in Cole's world, the exceptional accountant or financial planner or whatever, or in the world I operate around, which is all lawyers, fantastic solicitors. When it comes to being promoted, all of a sudden they've got anywhere from 3 to 15 people looking at them saying, well, this person is literally involved in my day. Many of them just can't step up to that level. So that's because the industry, even at the academic level, so even our universities, effectively don't, well, A, they don't promote leadership as a competence or a skill to develop as part of their development as a student. We're a very vocational education system. You go to university if you take the traditional pathway, and you invariably adopt a vocation, but you don't adopt in those degrees, and even with electives and whatever, you're not taught leadership. You're not actually taught how to run a business. I forget the author's name, Rich Dad Poor Dad. You know, he is it Kowalski, Cole? I'm not sure if you know the book.
Yeah.
He talks about how we need financial education. So you can learn to be an accountant, but do you understand how to run a business and how to generate revenue and how to minimize costs, understand your cost of doing business, those sort of things? So yeah, that's my view. My immediate answer is that I cannot say yes.
Cole? Yeah, look, for me, I'll take a slightly different perspective. I'll shy away from the financial services sector, because I think it's been in the limelight enough over the last number of years. But just from a leadership perspective, I look at the, you know, being based in regional North Queensland, what's the future of the region, and what's going to underpin that success? And that's leadership. And that's at different levels. There's obviously, you know, political leadership from whoever the incumbent government is at the particular point in time. But then you've got your industry groups, whether they might be an agricultural services group or a financial sectors group. But then you've also got entities like strategic think tanks that are looking at, well, what are the things that we should be advocating for our region? Because the decisions that we make today, you know, if you think in a strategic mindset, is what's going to ensure the success of the region 20 years down from the track. And it's going to give the region something to grow into. And it's going to, you know, I'd look at it very simply through the lens of, you know, what decisions should we be making now so that the region prospers? If the region prospers, then our clients prosper because their businesses will grow in that region. If the region isn't growing or it's shrinking, then it's harder for your clients to have that success. Now, I know here in Townsville, we're pretty lucky that, you know, we have an organisation called Townsville Enterprise Limited, which has been running for many, many years. And what they do effectively is they're trying to think about these things that are strategically important for the region, and how they can advocate for it, regardless of who's in power at federal government or state government or local government. They're focused on looking at outcomes for the region. Now, you know, one of the projects that they've looked at is the Museum of Underwater Art, which a lot of people in the region sort of laughed at a bit when it was first put out, and, you know, as Townsville Enterprise advocated for it. That's now coming to fruition. And when it's completed, it's already, people are saying within that tourism sector, and in the diving sector, that it will become one of the top 10 diving attractions in the world. Now, think of the decision that's made to do something like that and what that's going to contribute to the region. And that's come down to people who are thinking strategically long-term from a leadership perspective about what's best for the region or what's going to help our region grow. It's not incumbent upon them to do it. You know, they didn't have to go out there and put themselves out there and cop flak for it or cop praise for it, but they've gone and done it regardless. One thing I found really interesting in the lead in to the last federal election, just looking at Townsville, was a lot of people had this belief that we could either have a new football stadium or we could have, you know, water security. And you know, whenever that was put forward to me, I would challenge people and I would say, why do you think you're only entitled to one or the other? You know, what you really should be doing is advocating for, you know, I think we need this, you know, Museum of Underwater Art. We also need to improve the port facilities here in Townsville to support, you know, defence industry and export industry. We need water security, you know, Hell's Gate Dam in terms of opening up new agricultural land and the benefits that that will bring. And a new stadium. And look, that stadium has been built. And I haven't heard anyone knock it since it's been built, but there was a lot of knockers before it was built. And what we saw in the 2 weekends before COVID hit, so it had two grand openings. One was the Elton John concert. One was the North Queensland Derby between Brisbane and Broncos and the North Queensland Cowboys. Is the amount of money and activity that injected into the town was just phenomenal. You know, we had clients who in some hospitality sector saying, you know, we've done 2 months worth of revenue in two events, basically. And then unfortunately, COVID has come along and delayed that. But at the very least, we've seen what, you know, the money invested into that facility is going to deliver for the region up here and showcase the North. You know, if you've got a facility like that and you've got the ability to host other things that you wouldn't have been able to do previously. So I think it's important that people think beyond just their job or just beyond their career and think more broadly in terms of, you know, what can I be doing to help my region grow? And whether you're in Melbourne, whether you're in Sydney, whether you're in regional, you know, South Australia or, you know, regional North Queensland, you know, what can you be doing to contribute to the future success and the growth of this region? And, you know, I even think back, reflectively of I remember when Tony Abbott said I'm going to be known as the infrastructure king of Australia, and he was ousted 3 years later, sadly, without I don't think a single infrastructure project coming up. They're spending all this money on feasibility studies and everything else, and I just used to sit there and say, well, I can give you one off the bat. How about 2 lanes, you know, National Highway 1, 2 lanes from Brisbane all the way through to Cairns? You know, the amount of lost productivity on that highway. Yeah, yes, we're gradually getting there incrementally, but that's a lifeline from the north to the south, and that's a really easy win. You don't need to be Einstein to push that forward as a big infrastructure play and invest millions and millions of dollars in it and the jobs that come with it.
Note the last point was an LNP election statement too, Cole, in the recent Queensland election, and I totally agree with you. A dual-lane highway all the way to Cairns will do wonders for the state of Queensland. I've always thought that was the one of the key infrastructure projects we need in this state, but such is life. We'll hopefully see something a lot long-term. So, you know, when you think of a project like that, apparently it costs about $33 billion. So in today's numbers, it doesn't sound like much, does it, for what it will deliver?
Got the lowest interest rates available in the history of mankind. So if you're ever going to invest in big infrastructure projects, now would be a good time to do it. I know from my 2 years based over in America on exchange there in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, was whenever we went travelling, we'd get out on the highway and you'd be on 3 lanes of concrete highway, you know, going wherever you're going. And it was full, you know, but it was at the point of almost being overloaded from a capacity perspective. And then I remember one night before we were due to come back to Australia, they had on the news, you know, flashback, and it was 60-year anniversary of the Pennsylvania Turnpike. And here's this 3-lane concrete road that they built that had about 10 cars travelling on it. And, you know, why did that project come about? It came about from people thinking strategically, you know, post-World War II, how do we create jobs? How do we position the country for future growth? Let's go build this great big infrastructure a project, even though it's not required yet, let's just build it anyway. And, you know, here we are 68 years later, things are capacity and people are struggling with the decision about, well, what do we do next?
Oh, mate, I appreciate your time. This has been an excellent way to round off what has been five very interesting podcasts around those of you in leadership roles that have moved from those into the civilian world. And just for the sake of those that are listening, that this series is going to be continued in 2021, but the focus will shift to women that have left the Australian military and pursued careers in a civilian context. So my plan, and hopefully my co-host will be around in Brisbane unless he decides to migrate interstate next year, to continue the co-hosting role with me in the next year and to continue the series in 2021. Kyle, thank you again for your time, mate.
No, my pleasure. Thanks. Thanks very much for the invite. Hopefully people get something useful out of my ramblings and observations.
That was great, mate. Ben, any thoughts?
No, I'm certainly not rambling, Cole. I think I said to someone else yesterday, when a 90-minute chat feels like three, it means you're having a good time. So really, really appreciate your thoughts.
Thanks, gentlemen. For those listening, this has been Talking Leadership. We've been speaking this morning with Colin Lee, who is a partner with the Carey Group. Again, Kyle, thank you for your time. And again, as always, thank you to Ben Devison, who is my co-host and the founder guru of Lorganize. Again, thank you for your time, gentlemen.
Thanks, Eric. Thanks,
Nice.
Kyle.